morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today we're going to be talking about the forests of northern New Mexico. Joining us right now here in the cafe is Sam Hitt. He is the founder of Wild Watershed and of Forest Guardians, now known as Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
Great to have you again. And joining us by telephone is Kevin Stillman, who is a resident of the Jemez Mountains and is here to talk to us about a specific issue, namely the issue of off-road vehicles in the Jemez Mountains. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you were pretty heavily involved in getting a bill passed through the legislature relating to the issue of off-road vehicles. What was the whole bill about?
Senate Bill 379. What it wound up doing was it gave the enforcement of off-road vehicles to the Game and Fish Department, and it also changed the nature of the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Advisory Board from 27 members to 7 members, so it made something that hopefully will work a lot better. And it tried to do a few other things, and it didn't quite make it, but we got what we got, and we're kind of happy that it passed.
So changing the enforcement, what meant changing it from the Department of Tourism, where there seemed to be kind of a conflict of interest, because, of course, some tourists use off-road vehicles, and you don't want the tourist department telling them they can't use them. What are the actual rules that already exist about off-road vehicles?
Well, there's several rules. There's guidelines. There's a tread lightly program where off-road vehicles are supposed to go out and use the public land in a manner that doesn't hurt it. There are several rules as far as environmental damage, where to ride, where you can't ride. The different agencies, federal agencies, have different rules governing off-road vehicle use in the forest or wherever. It's all kind of the same thing. There's areas that are closed to them due to threatened and endangered species, riparian areas, and water quality. There's all kinds of rules that deal with them, and unfortunately, not very many of them are being enforced these days.
So the problem is not the existence of rules. The problem is the enforcement. How do you enforce the enforcers?
Well, that's what we're trying to do now. They're supposed to follow rules like everybody else does, and unfortunately, they're kind of ignoring their responsibilities, and what we're doing is trying to get them to actively enforce the rules and to accept the responsibilities that they're charged with, and that's what we're working on now, and we're just going to keep going until we can get something to happen.
What are some of the actual problems that off-road vehicles are causing in the forests in the Jemez Mountains where you live?
Well, there's a lot of erosion. The existing Forest Service system trails are being torn apart by off-road vehicle use. Instead of being just a nice path that everybody expects to see in the woods, these are basically just gullies that are 2 to 3 feet deep, 4 or 5 feet wide, covered in rocks. This doesn't even resemble a trail. There's damage to vegetation. There's damage to waterways, and there's damage to the threatened and endangered species from noise, from pollution, from dust, from all these different things. There's confrontations with bicycle riders, with horseback riders, with hikers, with hunters. There's no end to the problem, and it really needs to be addressed. A lot of people are upset about this, and we're just trying to get a handle on it.
When you have people who want to ride these vehicles, and I'm sure if you're a person who owns and rides one, it's pretty fun, where can they go where it's not damaging? Is that set up for people who have these vehicles?
Well, there's several places around the state. There's OHV parks that they can go and ride, and it's legal. And as far as the damaging, I haven't been there, I don't know, but these things are kind of inherently damaging. But at least there's an area that's set aside that they can go do whatever they want. You know, nobody can bother them. It's a, they have free reign of this place. But as far as being on public land, this is something that's that belongs to the public, and multiple use does not allow them to go out and destroy it. So that's where we feel they should be. There should be more regulations. There should be enforcement. People should be watching them. You know, like I say, if they go to an OHV park, that's fine. They can do what they want. But on public lands, they don't have the right to destroy it.
It's an issue that also affects air quality. I mean, you mentioned pollution. How bad a problem is that part of it?
Well, Sam is the one. He can tell you more about that. He did a lot of research on this. But with the two-stroke engines, it dumps out, I think, 25% of its fuel unburned, and this gets into the soil, it gets into the waterways, and it potentially there's a huge problem with that because it gets into everything.
There have been proposals to just close numbers of trails, and that would, maybe work, but it would also prevent people who use them in a non-harmful way to use those trails.
Well, the whole thing is, with this issue, is sustainability. And if there are such ways that people on motorized vehicles can use these trails in a sustainable fashion with no conflict, without annoying anybody else or getting anybody else's way, that's great. But the fact of the matter is that that's not the case. So, and what we're doing with this petition that we've got out is we're asking it close to motorized vehicles. Everybody else can pretty much get along up to a point. You know, it's not as bad. But the off-road vehicle issue is very, very big, affects a lot of people, and we need to step back and address it and not just ignore it and let things continue to get worse.
Now, you're from that area, a lifelong resident. Tell me how you use the trails and what's in it for you?
Well, anymore, I just hike. When I first came up here in the mountains, I used to ride a horse, and it was great. There's trails, there's old logging roads. I never ran into a off-road vehicle. It was kind of before the big days of the off-road vehicles. And then, 15 or so years ago, I started riding a mountain bike, mostly just to kind of get some exercise and as another way to poke around the woods. And at that point, the dirt bikers were starting to make their presence known. They were putting in some trails here and there. And originally I thought, well, this is great. Here's some nice single-track trails to ride. It's a lot of fun. But over the years, there was so much use and so little maintenance that the trails got torn up pretty bad to where it wasn't fun to go ride them anymore. A lot of times you have to get off and walk your bike because it was so eroded. I'm not that good a bike rider to ride on these trails and not have troubles. But mostly anymore, I just hike and a lot of times I don't even hike on the trails because it's easier to walk off the trail than on the trail. So I kind of avoid these guys as much as I can, and I still try and get out and enjoy the woods. But unfortunately, you can hear them from miles away, too. So you're kind of stuck with them no matter where you go, what you do.
There's also just the element of confrontation between, there are really two incompatible uses. I've had this situation in the dog park where there's people riding these things in the dog park, and you ask them to go away, and they've been quite unfriendly, to say the least.
Yeah, there is that too. For me, I can go get off the trail real quick and go run off in the woods, so I don't have to get into confrontation with these guys. I just kind of let them go. People on horseback don't really have that option. I have neighbors that ride horseback, and they're on a trail on the side of a steep hill. There's nowhere they can go. They hear a dirt bike coming. And, you go around a sharp corner, they can't tell what's going on. There a lot of them traveling at a high rate of speed. They can't stop in time. And so it's very, it's a dangerous situation, and people get worried about it. And some people are no longer able to ride on these trails because of that, because of not knowing what to do. They don't want to get hurt. They don't want their horses to get hurt. So there's a lot to this issue.
Now, there was a bill passed in the legislature. Has the governor signed it?
He signed it last week, I think it was.
Okay. And Sam Hitt wants to...
Yeah, I just to get back to this petition that Kevin mentioned that we filed. Kevin is the lead petitioner here, 75 local residents, several conservation groups. what we're seeking to do here is to get the Santa Fe National Forest to obey its own rules to shut down these trails where there's significant harm. They have an obligation that's actually been enforced since the early 1970s under President Nixon and later President Carter that instructed the National Forest to take action when there was damage to wildlife habitat, water quality, etc. So we want the Forest Service to do their job. We want them to act. And a lot of these problems that Kevin has been discussing can be dealt with if the Forest Service does its job properly.
Kevin Stillman is a resident of the Jemez Mountains and the lead petitioner on this petition. How do people sign this petition, Sam Hitt?
Well, you can take a look at it, number one, by going on the Wild Earth Guardians website. They were kind enough to post it there and to take a look at it. And if you agree that these 66 miles of trails, 27 separate segments of trails, if you agree that they should be shut down, at least temporarily, to repair the damage, then contact the Santa Fe National Forest and say you support this petition wholeheartedly. And also contact your elected representatives. Senator Bingaman has held hearings on this issue in the Senate, and Senator Udall and our Congressman Ben Ray Lujan. They would all love to hear from you, and we would love to have you contact them.
And Wild Earth Guardians can be found on the web at wildearthguardians.org. Kevin Stillman, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
So we're going to turn now to Sam Hitt, because there's a couple of issues that are, in fact, related, and the off-road vehicles is one of them, and Kevin was kind enough to be with us on the air just now. And then there's another one that is about the Forest Service's plans to reduce fuels, namely wood, in the Hyde Park area. Now, this is an area which is a watershed, which essentially is off the road when you go up from Santa Fe to the Santa Fe ski basin through Hyde Park, the westward slope there. Am I getting the geography right?
Yeah, you're getting it. Yeah, this is the area. This is the area that when the people take the scenic highway up to the ski area, and go along Little Tuzuki Creek, then head north. That's the whole area that the Forest Service is proposing a massive fuels treatment program. They're starting out relatively small. The first one they call the Hyde Park. The Hyde Park project is about 1,300 acres, but the entire what they call fire shed up to the north is almost 80,000 acres. So this is one of the key issues, Mary Charlotte, is that they're only analyzing the effects of this drastic tree fuels reduction or removal of trees on one small area, when the plan is to do the same thing on a much larger area.
So what's the motivation for this fuels treatment? I mean, we hear a lot about forests living here in northern New Mexico in a forested area, and sometimes, you know, wildfires at one point really kept the forest in shape through regular burns that just happened as a result of lightning strikes. Okay, now you have fire suppression. Is it true we have too much wood in the forest now?
Well, we've been living under this myth for at least a decade now that the forests are overgrown, that are too dense, that are susceptible to fire. And some of the fires during the last big drought cycle in the late 90s and early 2000s kind of drove this point home. And it was fear. It was the motivation of the Bush administration to unleash the timber industry again that we had hemmed in from old-growth logging. So I take exceptions with this word thinning to reduce fuels, because it's actually, in the Hyde Park project, they want to take down 97% of the trees. They want to go from a forest where, you know, 1,200 to 1,400 trees per acre down to about 40 to 60 trees per acre. Now, it's true, most of these trees are smaller trees, but what we're seeing with climate change is that the replacement of older trees by younger trees is happening much slower than we thought. So if we do this very aggressive, dramatic fuels reduction or forest removal, I call it, we could not have a forest in a few decades as conditions get warmer and drier.
So when you talk about the forest being overgrown, are you saying that's not the case, or are you saying that a little bit of overgrowth is necessary because of changing climate conditions?
Well,
or
yeah, it's a natural cycle. What we have, if you look back through the long geological record, is we have periods of high rainfall of moisture, and then the trees grow and become dense. Then we have periods of dry, and fires come and thin out the forest. Fire is not an unnatural part of this ecosystem. In fact, fire is like rain is to the rainforest. Fire to the ponderosa pine ecosystem in the Southwest is very much like rain is to the rainforest. So we have to learn to live with fire. We have to take precautions for sure. We can't allow development to spread into these susceptible areas, in the same way we can't allow people to build houses in the floodplain, because we know that those areas are going to be flooded in time. It's the same thing. There is going to be fire in areas that are dominated by, in this case, ponderosa pine and Douglas fir.
So the way the story goes is that because of decades of fire suppression, you know, Smokey the Bear, don't start a forest fire and all of that, which, you know, you don't want to start a forest fire in places where there are people camping and so on. But because of fire suppression, then there is an overgrowth of trees that then leads to more severe wildfires.
Well, again, this is part of the myth.
And it's not true?
It turns out that the influence of climate is much more important than our token efforts to suppress fire over the years. And so, again,
meaning climate change.
Climate change, yeah. So, but, you know, we are seeing a swing to a drier, warmer climate now, but this is not the first time. This is on a regular, periodic basis. In the 1200s, there was a 25-year drought in the Southwest. It was very widespread. It probably wiped out the Anasazi civilization. We may be facing something similar now. A lot of people who study climate think so in the American Southwest and northern Mexico. But in any case, we have exaggerated our role in harming the ecosystem, and that's part of this arrogance that professional foresters have. Well, we created the problem, therefore we have a responsibility to solve it. Actually, why don't we sit back and take a harder look at this issue? Again, we should be reducing fuels in the immediate vicinities of existing homes. We should be stopping development further up in the private land in the Hyde Park area, for example. But for people who live there, that I have gone around these homes, they need to reduce those flammable fuels, mainly trees, shrubs, and grasses, within about 30 feet of their homes, especially near the windows, because during a fire, hot flashes of combustible fuels will blast right through the windows, and that's what burns their homes down. So if they do that, this is the good news. Their homes will survive a wildfire, but it's a mistake to think we can stop fire, that we can fireproof the forest, that we can take these efforts that will reverse these natural trends.
Now, when I think of 30 feet, that's about from my table to the edge of the parking lot here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. A margin
it's
that's...
It's not quite that far.
Okay, but, you know, it's not very far.
Yeah. Okay, well, they don't have to take down all the fuels.
No, but let's say they take down everything and you have a nice 30-foot area around your house, and then there's a forest fire.
Right.
Your house is going to be fine?
Yeah. That there's very good research to show that's the case. There's very dramatic photos that show that people have taken these so-called fuels reduction measures immediately around their homes, survive the hottest, the most catastrophic crown fires that nature can throw at you. Of course, it also they have a metal roof instead of a shake wooden roof, and to keep your wood stored, for firewood away from the home, and simple precautions like that.
And you don't get cooked inside of your own house?
No. In fact, the best fire prevention strategy for people who are caught in a fire, like there's a fire raging up, and is not to get in your car and try to outrun it, but to stay in your home. So it's protection in place. Those tragedies in Australia recently was a lot of people tried to flee the fire, and they were in their homes with a tank full of gas or in their cars, gas tanks exploded.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah, so a lot of people lost their lives. Best to stay in place. As long as you've taken those precautions, then you should be fine.
We're talking to Sam Hitt, founder of Wild Watershed, about the plans that the Forest Service has and some of the responses to those plans for fuel management in the Hyde Park area in the watershed. What's at stake in that area?
Well, it's really the future of the forest. It's as simple as that. I mean, we're really in a fork in the road. We can continue on this path of, well, we have a responsibility, we have the knowledge, and we can fireproof these forests. We can take these aggressive actions, and things will be better.
Or, meaning the Forest Service plan.
Yeah, this is basically the Forest Service attitude coming from our long tradition of humanism, if you will, or the arrogance of humanism, or it's the reliance on science and technology to solve all problems that nature creates. Or we can really step back and take a deep breath, take these really these measures as I've described to protect people's homes, not to allow urban sprawl to expand into these susceptible areas, and basically let fire do its job in every case that we can. You know, a lot of people have the experience with the Cerro Grande fire. Oh, it was, you know, it just cooked the soil and everything was killed. Well, that was at about 1/3 of the 60,000 acres that burned. If you go back up in the backcountry between Los Alamos and Abiquiu now, you'll see huge stands of aspen, grasses that have been released by the fire and where nutrients have been recycled. A huge increase in wildlife species that depend on burned forests to survive. A lot of the woodpeckers, for example. So, again, fire is an essential ingredient to restart the ecosystem, to renew the ecosystem in the Southwest, and we really have to let it do its job.
Now, back to that question of really hot crown fires versus lower, milder fires.
This is a key source of disagreement. A lot of people who have studied the ponderosa pine ecosystem, the dominant tree in the Hyde Park area and elsewhere, say, well, there's been a long history of cool ground fires, and then fire suppression has altered that pattern.
Yes. Well,
there's certainly
people have said that on this very show.
Yeah, and that's part of the reigning mythology. So if you look back at the science, you know, again, this is a problem of only taking one segment of what we can know about an ecosystem. In this case, the tree rings. So you have to find enough tree rings. The oldest tree rings we have go back 500 years. Well, this ecosystem is at least 10 million years old. If you go back and look, like Glenn Myers has done at UNM, at the alluvial fans and then the charcoal deposits over there, so you can have a much longer time frame. Instead of tree rings, it's the charcoal deposits. You'll see that, yes, there has been a long history of relatively cool, frequent fires, but then occasionally you have these restarting events, if you will. You have huge fires that basically take out everything. We might be at that point now. We might not. It might be aggravated by global warming. We're just not sure. But in any case, nature has to, you know, in my view, we have to ride the horse. We have to let nature do its job. Nature knows more than we do. We have to tone down our arrogance and view the knowledge that we have as an infinitesimal point of light in a gigantic universe of darkness.
So if we were to rein in our human arrogance and step back and do absolutely nothing whatsoever and let the forest restore itself and let nature take its course? Would the forest restore itself and everything would, all the species would be happy and everybody but perhaps
well,
some human beings?
Yeah, there's constant change, and some species would not be happy, and some would. A lot of people bemoan the fact that there'll be big holes in the forest where you have hot fires, the soils have cooked, and there'll be grasses and shrubs there for long periods of time.
As opposed to trees.
But at the landscape scale, those holes in the forest are good things. They create diversity. They create habitat for a whole slew of warblers that are declining, for example. Some of those oak fields that you see in the Hamath that turn such a brilliant red in the fall are the result of hot fires of in the past, probably thousands of years ago. And they stayed these oak fields over all that time, and that again has created diversity at the landscape scale. Yeah, it's a disaster for those 100 or 1,000 acres of forest that have been consumed by fire. But again, we need to step back, ask a larger question, look at a longer period of time, so-called deep time perspective, and always be conscious of our arrogance and always be conscious of how little that we know. And I'm not saying do nothing.
Right. Well, that's the question. I mean, if we do have, this is the problem with any complex system. We have a knowledge of some part of that system and then we try to apply that and we get unintended consequences. But we do know some things about forests, and in fact, your plan, there is something called the Draft Citizens Restoration Plan for the Headwaters Fireshed, which is this Hyde Park area that we're talking about, and which you and Wild Earth Guardians and many other people have signed on to.
Right.
There is a plan that draws on our, arrogant or non-arrogant human knowledge?
Well, it's taking a very light-handed approach to this problem of fuels reduction. So one of the big problems with fuels reduction, you got to put in these roads, you got to put in these off-road vehicle trails, and you have a lot of soil erosion. The Hyde Park project itself is going to produce at least 1,000 tons of topsoil every time they go in, and they have to go in between every 10 and 20 years. About 30,000 tons of that soil wind up in the stream. So into Zuki Creek, that's going to degrade water quality and aquatic habitat. So you want to minimize those problems if you're going to do fuels reduction. One way to do it is an old technique called contour felling. It's basically taking down some of the smaller trees, putting them perpendicular to slopes, staking them on the downhill side, backfilling on the uphill side, and arranging the logs on a shingle pattern on the slope. That holds the soil in place. In time, those logs break down and enrich the soil. So
I think that is an important thing that we have to talk about, that both what you call contour felling, which is cutting down trees and arranging them, and fire do, which is that they return the mineral content of the trees to the soil.
Yeah, that's extreme. So it's biomass, a scientific word, and you want to keep as much of that in the forest, even if it's charcoal. You know, it's incredibly important. It's the building blocks for the next stage of forest succession. So now the Forest Service has taken a look at this. We've been arguing about it for at least a decade now, and they say it's too labor intensive. It requires too much skilled labor. You have to train people how to do this. You can't do it in a halfway measure. You got to do it properly, or it creates more problems than it solves. And it's too expensive. Well, in these times, it seems we're throwing tens of billions of dollars trying to create jobs in this country. We should be creating jobs in forest restoration that would train a skilled workforce to do this kind of contour felling in these areas where fire has the potential to harm homes and structures.
When you talk about doing contour felling, cutting down the trees and arranging the trunks on the ground and propping them up and so on, do you need roads to get to those areas, or do people hike through the woods to get there to do this contour felling?
Yeah, we don't need heavy equipment. It's basically foot traffic. So people carrying chainsaws. There might be cases where you'd have to have a a six-wheeled vehicle, you know, up on a ridgetop or something. But that'd be very minor compared to what the Forest Service wants to do. They want to bring in these gigantic machines called masticators that chip up the trees, that cause soil compaction, that create these avenues for sediment to bleed off the hillsides. So it's a big problem. You know, I'd like to go into kind of a complicated issue, but it's not really, because it really gets at the justification for this whole project. What the Forest Service wants to do, let's just take their assumptions for a minute, is they want to create reduced fuels for a certain period of time. That period of time is between 10 and 20 years. So they're buying 10 or 20 years of basic fire resistance. But in the meantime...
And would that, I mean, just in the short run, 10 to 20 yeah. years of fire resistance, in your view, looking at their plan, would that be effective? Would that forest be more resistant?
No. During that time, there is a short-term increase in fuels. See, you're leaving all those twigs and branches on the forest floor.
Oh, so when you masticate them, you leave them on the floor?
Yeah. You chip them up, and they're on the floor. And so as you open up the canopy, sunlight gets down and dries out those fuels. So what the Forest Service agrees to, everybody recognizes, is a short-term increase in fire danger.
Until those things turn into compost and return to the earth?
Right, exactly. So what is short-term? Well, it's probably 10 to 15 years. So... like, what are you buying in your fuels reduction efforts?
So you're, hang on. If I'm getting the, you're doing a fire reduction project. Fuels reduction project to reduce the risk of fire for 10 years, but you're increasing it for 10 years.
Just about, yeah. There's almost a complete overlap. And now here's the other part of it, is that what is the chance of a fire going to come in the 1,300-acre area on Hyde Park in the next 10 to 20 years? Well, there's been a lot of research done on that, and it's about 0.1%.
That lightning will strike that area on a dry day.
That you have to, so it's a probability. So, but at the meantime, you're bleeding 100, you're bleeding 1,000, almost 1,000 tons of topsoil, 30,000 tons of that's going to wind up in the streams. What are you gaining?
Well, I mean,
just to quote from this research, potentially adverse effects on watersheds are not counterbalanced by benefits from reduced fire severity. That was a scientific paper that was published last year. And again, we're starting to see this myth of thinning, fuels reduction. We're starting to look at what it really means on the ground. And hopefully the wheels are going to come off this baby, and we're going to come to our senses, and we're going to be taking these much more benign efforts to help people protect their homes.
What is the motivation for the plan that you are against? I mean, if it's the way you say it is, it doesn't even make sense.
It doesn't make sense, but you're not inside the bureaucracy. See, I'll be a bit cynical here. There's a desire to create a justification for your bureaucracy. Busy work, we call it. You got to create a crisis. You have to build on fear, fear of fire in this case. And then you have to come up with a solution. Even if that solution admits, well, in the past we did it wrong, we suppressed fires. Now we got to go in and reduce fuels to prevent fires in the future. It's all part of an integrated program that has a lot of questionable assumptions, and we really should be taking a much harder look. That's why we're advocating that they step back, look at the whole area that they want to treat, look at the latest scientific research, base a program not on the climate we have today, but on the climate of the future, which is going to be much drier and warmer than it is currently.
We're talking to Sam Hitt. He is the founder of Wild Watersheds and Forest Guardians, which is now Wild Earth Guardians. And we're talking about the Citizens Restoration Plan for the Headwaters Fire Shed and the Forest Service Plan for that same area.
You know, we should probably mention, Mary Charlotte, that there'll be a debate tomorrow night at the downtown library at 6 o'clock, where a lot of these same issues we're discussing today will be aired. The Forest Service will be there. There'll be certainly people that have a contrary view to mine. And we'll
so that's at the Santa Fe Public Library on Washington.
Correct.
Downtown.
correct.
At 7 o'clock.
Six o'clock. You know, one other important issue here that I think we have to take a hard look at is when they do these prescribed fires. So this is, they want to do the fuels reduction. They want to follow up with these management fires or prescribed fires. That a tremendous amount of mercury is released into the atmosphere. This is something that an issue has been avoided for at least 10 years.
Mercury?
Mercury
is coming up everywhere. Yesterday was in high fructose corn syrup. Today it's in, where is it coming from?
It's from everywhere. Well, New Mexico, I'm sorry to inform my fellow New Mexicans, has the highest concentrations of airborne mercury in the nation by far.
Heavens.
And that is because of mostly because of the coal-fired power plants that are spewing mercury almost 5,000 pounds per year. Now, a lot of that mercury settles into the soil on the foliage, and when it's burned, it's released back into the atmosphere. So all we're asking the foresters at this stage is to go in and analyze the vegetation, take soil samples, and determine how much mercury would be released when they do their prescribed fire. We think this is reasonable, and they're resisting.
Now, this is another question that I wanted to raise with you, which is when you look at all these different factors that we're talking about, there is a real need for study and for data. Do we have that study? Do we have that data? Who's doing it?
Well, you know, the best scientists in this field have advocated for years site-specific data on the fire history in a particular area. Now, often it's said, oh, well, you know, our forest used to only have, 30 to 40 trees per acre, and there was a fire, there was a cool fire burned through every 5 to 7 years. Well, that was true for some of the ponderosa pine forests around Flagstaff, where, it turns out, that's where the Forest Service has a research station and has for almost 80 years. Well,
Can't generalize from Flagstaff to Santa Fe.
Yeah, the ponderosa pine grows here. It also grows in Flagstaff, but it's an entirely different fire regime or fire history.
Interesting.
And we have much denser forests. We're part of the Southern Rockies ponderosa pine zone. Over in Flagstaff, it's part of the Mogollon Rim ponderosa pine zone. There are at least 11 different ponderosa pine zones in the West extending to Mexico. So, you know, we really can't rely on generalized data. We need site-specific data if we're going to do intelligent management.
Do we have that?
No, we don't in this particular area. Now, they have, because of pressures from a lot of good scientists here in Santa Fe and elsewhere, we do have some of the fire history from the Santa Fe watershed, which is close, and that's good, but it's not in the Hyde Park area. And that's what we really need. There really is enough of a difference that it's important to have really site-specific data. And it's interesting, some of the preliminary data in the watershed shows that back in the 1840s, I believe it is, maybe it was the 1820s, there was a huge fire that was a result of drought in the ponderosa pine that typically experiences low-severity ground fires. They had a big crown fire. So had nothing to do with fire suppression. They weren't suppressing fires back then. So it was, again, it was tied into climate and drought. That's the major driving force in our forests.
There's another factor that is in your proposal, which is to reintroduce beavers into that area to protect water quality.
Yeah, my favorite animal. You know, the first thing that really happened when Anglo culture came into the Southwest is the beavers were trapped out. They were almost gone by the early 19th century, 1812, 1815, 1820.
To make coats and stuff?
Felt hats and beaver hats for the Europeans. It's amazing, that market. They wiped out the beavers starting the East Coast, going all the way through the Great Lakes states, up into Canada, down to the Rocky Mountains, into Mexico. So thank goodness the beaver survives. It's a very adaptable rodent. But the problem is the watersheds were dramatically changed.
Because of the killing of the beavers.
Yeah. They you know, these are nature's engineers. They go in these areas, they slow down the water, they trap the nutrients, they create habitat for fish. And birds and aquatic life. Without beavers, beavers are the keystone species, much like prairie dogs are to the prairie.
Right.
So, you know, without them, you have a whole different system. And that's what we have. And so by reintroducing the beavers, we can start to protect water quality again. It's not hard to do, but it receives a lot of resistance. Actually, I have to compliment the Forest Service. They have let the beavers thrive in the watershed. So on the Santa Fe River, between the two reservoirs, there's now a healthy beaver population, and they've created a lot of wetlands and excellent habitat for aquatic life.
It must be amazing to reintroduce an animal like that as a human action, and then some years down the road see the result of it and see the changes.
Yeah, you know, and with beavers, it's quick. That's the amazing thing. And, you know, again, it's this thing, are they creative or are they destructive? I mean, beavers are clear cutters. They'll take down every single cottonwood and aspen and willow in an area, then move on. And then when they grow back, they'll come back, you know. So they need an entire reach of streams to support a healthy beaver population. You can't just keep them in one place forever.
So when you talk about reintroducing them into the Hyde Park area, where specifically are you talking about?
Little Tuzuki Creek, yeah. And
are they compatible with all the hikers and doggies and stuff that go around there?
Again, we'll have to live with fire. We're going to have to live with beavers, you know. And I think we can do it. I think our souls are large enough. I think we can, you know, tame our worst instincts to harness, basically turn nature to human benefit. It's more than that. We're only one species on this planet, and we have to live in a stance of respect.
And that leads to another question, which I think is very important to bring up, to discuss, to think about, and that is, why do you want to restore forests, conserve forests, have pristine wilderness? Is it for the sake of human beings? Is it for the sake of the species themselves, for their own sake, some combination? Sam Hitt, how do you think about it?
Well, you know, it's the fate of our public lands, Mary Charlotte. You know, we have, for example, wilderness areas where basically roads and logging are prohibited. They constitute about 4% of America. So we're asking all the native wildlife that this country, that this great continent provided for, to find habitat in these last remaining little segments of wilderness.
For 4% of the
what
used to be the whole continent.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, right now it's a scenic lands. It's what we call rock and ice, you know, for the most part, and that's not often the best habitat. So the river deltas, the lower elevation areas, the riparian areas. A lot of those are just consumed. I mean, 99% or more of our riparian areas have been developed. The water's been diverted. You know, livestock graze in them, and they don't provide the habitat they used to. So.
So what happens when rivers? Do they die?
Rivers have died. The Rio Grande is a dead river, for all practical purposes. Yes, there's water there. But, you know, look at the Rio Grande, as we've talked about, I think, on other shows. You know, I was just down in the Las Cruces area. It used to be 10 to 12 miles wide down there. Now it's confined into a concrete channel. That's not the river it once was. We've taken away its life force, which in this case was flooding. So, you know, again, flooding like fire was considered a destructive impact. We had to control, build the dams like Kochi Dam is a flood control structure. In our efforts to control nature, we've killed nature. We've killed entire river systems.
And it seems, I mean, getting back to this question, which is, it's partly a philosophical question, but it's also, I mean, it seems to me that when you confine wildlife to a small area, even if you don't really care about wildlife for its own sake or species for their own sake, you are ultimately destroying your own life and habitat and ability to, you know, eat and breathe and live as a human species.
Well, we're all connected, you know, and what happens the least among us happens to us all, whether it's in terms of humanity or, as my friend David Abrams says, the more than human universe. We have to look broadly. We have to control our instincts to act based on limited knowledge. We have to control our instincts to act on fear. You know, evolutionary, in the evolutionary sense, it was probably advantageous to act on fear, you know, to gather up your family and protect them from the hyenas on the African savanna. But at this point of human evolution, it's a liability. We have to, you know, trick, or we have to tame the instincts that we've inherited from evolution if we're going to survive on the planet.
So, in this particular issue, what are you asking people to do? I mean, they can come to the meeting tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Public Library and talk about it. How can citizens be involved in protecting their forests?
Well, again, I think we're at the early stages where we're opening up this whole question of thinning to reduce fuels. So become informed, number one, that is, come to the forum. There's lots of good materials that have been written on this. A lot of that you can find on the Wild Earth Guardians website. It's also very helpful to go to the town meetings that the politicians do. Like, for example, Ben Ray Lujan is going to do his first rounds of town hall meetings. You know, he's going to take the rail runner down to Bernalillo. Well, take a ride with him. You know, sit in his lap and ask him to, you know, look at these things. I mean, if they don't hear from citizens, all they hear from are the experts. And if that's all that influences policy, we'll get more of the same. So that's, you know, I know it takes time, but that's really important. If you can't do anything else, just send an email. Just a couple sentences always helps.
To your elected representatives.
Yes, to the elected representatives.
It's funny. It seems like they hear from experts. Sometimes that's probably a good thing to hear from experts if those experts are forest scientists. They also hear from lobbyists. They also hear from bureaucrats. They also hear from commercial interests.
Yeah. There's a lot of parasites on the system now that benefit from keeping things the way they are. For example, the masticator that's going to be doing this work in Hyde Park is from Montana. You know, it's a crew. He's a perfectly nice guy. I've met him, but it's just one guy in a big machine, and you know, a bunch of cheap labor that he can get off the street to help him move his equipment and stuff. So, you know, a skilled workforce just critically important. Take that idea from medicine, you know, do no harm, and apply that to the ecosystem. If we did that, if we could convince our land managers to follow that ethic of the medical profession, we would have a much different forest policy than we have today.
Sam Hitt is the founder of Wild Watershed and Forest Guardians, which is also known as Wild Earth Guardians at this point. They changed their name, and they can be found on the web at wildearthguardians.org. And Sam Hitt, are there any other links or connections that people should know about? Any numbers or websites you'd like to give?
Yeah, although it's a little bit outdated, and it's all my fault, the Once a Forest website, so it's onceaforest.org.
Onceaforest.org.
It is a great resource. It was done by Sarah Williams. We tragically lost Sarah about a year and a half ago, and we haven't been able to maintain it like we should have, but there's a lot of great information on this Hyde Park project there, as well as these larger issues.
Sam Hitt, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. And if you have any questions about what you heard or need some of those numbers or names or websites or anything, please feel free. I try to answer my email all the time. We are streaming ksfr.org. I said that. We are also podcasting at the website santafe radio cafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.